Hi, Jen.
Hey, Tony, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm not able to get my camera since I'm moving. I'll be voice only for this meeting.
Okay, thanks. Your audio is coming across very good.
Yeah.
Sounds good. So, Jen, do you want me to just get started? We can do it quickly. I'll just, for the record, I'll list the names of attendees, for the roll call.
Sounds great. Thanks, Michael. Okay.
Sure. So for the record, Michael Yaffe, Michael Baker, Jennifer Miller, Jessica Broker, Carl Hahnemann, Shana Cosone, and I apologize if I mispronounced names, Tony Izzo, Neat Barat with Michael Baker, and Malia Walters, so Michael Baker. So, Jen, I know you asked me to kind of walk through this. I put together a preliminary agenda. High level, I know this subcommittee is going to be meeting on September 14th. It's going to be an all-day meeting. Part of this meeting is to kind of prep for that, and then this meeting is also just kind of a check-in to kind of go through the actions and then the coordination with where the other kind of subcommittees are as well. And I do just want to kind of just show you just a sneak preview of everything I have, that I want to walk through at this meeting, and then I'll defer to Tony and Jen what has priority and what you want to talk through first. But we do have the kind of the list of actions that were presented at the task force meeting. I know these may need to be reviewed and refined further, and that's part of the intention of the all-day kind of meeting. But we can, if there's items on this list that are easy that you know you want to change right away, we can use this meeting to kind of talk through that. The other thing is I just wanted to remind everyone kind of the overall kind of format that Michael Baker suggested in the July meeting for at the end of this, the final deliverable is going to be more of an executive style report. And we may consider grouping the actions in a similar way that the data subcommittee kind of grouped them. Now, the data subcommittee, if you remember from the task force meeting, they had a two-day technical working session to kind of simplify all of their actions into four high-level categories and then created kind of sub-actions underneath them. That kind of aligns with the high-level organizational framework we were recommending from the beginning, where you would have your subcommittee and then your kind of high-level grouping of a strategy and then your kind of sub-actions underneath that. I didn't want to kind of enforce that grouping at first. I'd rather the subcommittees work through, identify all the actions that they think are relevant, go through the exercises that you need, and then the last step is kind of just organizing them into a higher level grouping. So having said all that, the Coastal Subcommittee, and Duff kind of took this on his own initiative, I just wanted to show this as well. Now, the executive level summary that we were talking about for the final report, what the document I'm about to show you, Duff probably provided too much information, and we don't want to exclude anything from the final report. We want to synthesize it and refine it, so any extra information will be included, but it may go in appendices. But Duff took a first pass at taking one of his actions that he was passionate about and kind of did a write-up and then was considering the categories that might be considered for the final report. And he did this on his own initiative. And this obviously needs to be discussed at a higher level with the task force. But broadly speaking, the categories do align with the categories we've been kind of talking about. Maybe we have to agree on certain nomenclature. But let me just kind of run through overall those broad categories, the name of the action, a brief description of the background of the issue or the action, the value proposition of kind of why you're recommending this action, and then Duff did a detailed accounting of, how we get there. And this is probably more detailed than you might typically need, just kind of the implementation steps. Again, if it's a action that is high priority, it's, you know, immediately going to be implementable. Maybe you already have a lot of research and due diligence. You know the steps. It's okay to include that. But for a lot of these actions at this time, you may not have all this information, and that's okay. So I don't want to scare you by showing this two-page write-up, because I don't think that level of effort is needed for every action. And then he has the implementation timeline and then kind of expected results. So that's something for consideration. And one thing he offered from Michael Baker was maybe we take this and maybe the data subcommittees and start formatting those actions into what it may look like in kind of a final report. And we can definitely have that prepared for the Rail Belt subcommittee meeting for consideration as you kind of talk through your actions. So just wanted to pause there. Any questions related to that in the format? I know this is more administrative and housekeeping.
Michael, I think it's helpful to visualize the deliverables, so appreciate you bringing this back up and refreshing us on the format. And then as far as the recommendations that are in the Excel file, just for context, those are things that have been brought up during various task force meetings and have been captured by Michael Baker for consideration for the subcommittee. Is that correct?
There's multiple ways that this they could have gotten here. It's either, another subcommittee may have, discussed it and said, oh, that'd be good for the Rail Belt, or they might have thought an action and then concluded that's more of a Rail Belt action, let's add it to their list. And then, we did try and capture some actions that just came up during conversation. Again, fully acknowledging this is not the final or approved list. This is just all kind of draft working, kind of list of actions, and that's why we defer. Our job is mostly just to help facilitate, so we didn't want to lose ideas, but we are looking to task force members to help, as the subject matter experts, to help refine and kind of define these actions a little better. And that's hopefully what we'll do on that working day session. And then the other actions are actions that came from, the SES plan, just for plan integration. Some committees, when they review the SES action, because that plan is, already a year old, it may already been, an implemented action, it may be outdated. So you can actually withdraw these actions, you can integrate it into other actions you already have recommended, or you can just roll them into this plan. And that is going to be a kind of a question for the plan too, how this plan integrates with that plan, because that plan does have a 5-year update process. So do actions from this plan also get rolled into that plan? And I just wanted to throw that out there. That's a larger discussion for another time. But that's kind of the relationship of these actions. So it might be a fruitful exercise to go through these actions and talk about, in preparation of the all-day meeting, is there information you may need ahead of time to help facilitate the all-day discussion for some of these actions, or some of these actions outright, you don't want to include, or there was concerns, or you may need additional information. So I just wanted to pause here. I know I've been doing a lot of talking, but I'm interested to hear from, the members and the co-chairs.
I think it'd be useful maybe to do a quick screen. I could see, some of these recommendations people have different opinions on. And so, we may not be able to get into it fully here, but I like the idea of screening up. Is there something that folks want to see ahead of or to be included in the workshop session on September 14th? Any thoughts on your end, Tony?
Dan, I have a couple of thoughts. I think we could go through this list. When I look at it, I would combine a number of these because I think they mean the same thing, they're just in different words, and we would need to articulate that, see if you agreed, see if the committee agreed. But when I look at the last one under SED's action for consideration, Rail Belt Transmission Line Capacity Expansion, to me, that's already that's already covered, if not wholly by some others, like the first one, certainly is in combination with things like invest in grid innovation, battery storage. I mean, you could plays a role there, but so that's my first, you know, my first thought in looking at these, and I'll just pause there.
I will say that makes sense, and it is in, you know, what other subcommittees have also done is they've combined some of the SEDS actions with their own because they thought they were duplicative.
Yeah, Michael, there's a Rail Belt Clean Energy Portfolio SEDS action is, you know, Rail Belt 9, adopt a clean energy standard. I think that could be a relatively quick exercise that, you know, Jen and I can propose in advance, or we can do maybe early part of the Thursday or the September 14th strategy meeting. And I'll pause again. I'll just pause there to get a reaction to that. You know, for me, it leads into some other things that I'd like to get on the table.
That sounds good. Tony, the floor is yours.
Yeah. maybe I'll just touch on one other thing before, because Rail Belt number 3, the evaluate multiple utility governance structures and the impact of cost is, you know, I have a pretty good sense of, you know, I've worked in the business for a few decades, and I've worked in the investor-owned model. I've worked in the cooperative model. I've worked indirectly with municipal models. The Rail Belt today is 4 cooperatives and 1 very small municipal that has been up for sale. The vote failed. It's going back. Seward Electric's going back up for sale. You know, that's our back up for a vote to sell to Homer Electric. That's on the table. You've got 4 cooperatives, and this one, in my opinion, would require, we can make a recommendation that to further evaluate the legal and statutory requirements. I'd be good with that. Otherwise, I think we would need a subject matter expert like an Andy Lehman, who is regulatory counsel. He's very involved in the industry. He's on a utility board. He's the Alaska Power Association's counsel. He's not MEA's counsel, but he's the MEA board counsel, as well as others. And so he understands the statutes around, utility regulation as well as anybody. But my cursory understanding of this is that it takes a supermajority, depending on bylaws, you would need something like 75% of the members to vote. We're lucky to get 10%. And you would need a 2/3 majority of that 75% to sell anything. Otherwise, you're looking at a kind of a forced takeover, which I think would be challenged legally by some as a taking. So I think there's just a longer strategy around this, and I would hate for the perfect to get in the way of the good. Some of the first battles that you would get into here is the members, because no investor-owned would provide power. These co-ops were formed, and you have different, you know, governing bodies that have made different decisions based on, you know, what their members have voted for. So in my particular case, I'm next door neighbor to a co-op that has barely a third of the equity I have. And if you were to take that equity away from those 70,000 meters to cover somebody else's perceived bad decisions, it's just ripe for legal challenge. And I'll just drop it there because it's a lengthier conversation. I really like the idea, and I think that the better way to approach this, in my opinion, would be to start with the transmission. I think we could make some ground, you know, we could get our foot in the door in terms of significant railbelt institutional reform, and then look at, you know, maybe the next step would be a single generation and transmission cooperative, or single generation and transmission entity once you got the transmission authority up and running. The wholesale merger of the distribution utilities would be difficult, and if you try to just make a recommendation, you're just asking for lawsuits unless we, you know, spend some time on it. So I'll pause there, because that one to me jumps out as being very different than the others, and the one that I look at and I think, oh God, this could be a real legal mess or a lobbying mess, and I would rather figure out what it is that we want and be successful in stages than try to eat the whole elephant in one bite.
And Tony, just following on that context and background, I agree with you. So Railbelt 1, sell all existing transmission assets along the Railbelt and Browns Lake to AEA or a new regulated utility for the net book value. You know, maybe that one instead of, I don't know that we've actually, you know, assessed the pros and cons of that, or like, you know, what tangible savings will we get by doing that? I think it's a potentially good idea, but could we make this a short-term action and say, assess the, you know, rate impacts or something like that, associated with putting all transmission assets and Bradley Lake under one entity? And then, you know, make the decisions for there, and then we can say what we think the potential, I like how it kind of calls out what we think some of the potential benefits, what they could be, but rather than just going for, like, let's straight out decide today that we're going to sell all transmission assets to one entity.
Yeah.
You know, I guess, or do we feel like we know enough that we're good recommending that?
I think we'd be good recommending it in the following form, and that's based on, you know, a view of the landscape or the radar screen. And, you know, what we have on the, you know, on the landscape right today is significant federal dollar availability. And I think we all agree that, you know, we should seek that funding and, you know, not just to build stuff and add to rate base, but to achieve some goal, which comes back to the affordability, economic development, affordability, reliability, and resiliency. So, you know, to me, you have federal dollars available. You have an infrastructure with fragmented ownership that is security constrained, which means that you're restricted. Think about the Whittier Tunnel, for example, and, you know, you have to wait until the flow changes so that, you know, you're sitting there parked waiting for the flow to change so that you can drive through to Whittier or wait until the hour when you can drive out of Whittier. And that's what Golden Valley or the Interior is, and that's what Homer Electric, you know, both of those are, I should say, Fairbanks and the Interior and the Kenai Peninsula are security constrained. That's the terminology, but they do not have, I mean, they have advantages based on geography and circumstances, but there are disadvantages. Whereas Matanuska Electric and Chugach Electric tie together a number of places. That's why we're in, you know, working towards forming a single load balancing area where we could take turns, but one of us would basically operate the system as if it were a single entity, and that's already been ordered by the Regulatory Commission. That's an effort that's underway. It's had some hiccups, but you really can't, you know, those other regions can't take advantage of that. So in addition to that, you know, that's just describing the landscape. You have state ownership of assets that the state has built. You have Bradley Lake, and you have the transmission coming out of Bradley Lake, for, you know, a few tens of miles, And then you have the northern intertie that connects the Matanuska Electric Service Territory with Golden Valley. And we hear Golden Valley report on an annual basis what that line has saved them in fuel costs, and it's often in the $37 to $40 million range. Well, I'm the third largest buyer of gas in Cook Inlet, and my annual bill is $45 million. So it's, you know, when you compare the rates on a per kilowatt hour basis, you see that they're higher in the interior. But I look at that northern intertie, which, by the way, is others don't realize, is right next to that beautiful solar farm that Renewable IPP, led by you, has constructed. It's a constant reminder to me of an example where investment was made that more, it pays for itself year after year after year, with residents or consumers in the interior saving a collective $40 million after tax on their utility fuel bill. So I've got fragmented ownership, I've got state ownership, I've got federal dollars coming in that can't go to the utilities. They will have to go to AEA, they will have to be matched by the state, and none of that, the state or AEA can't just give that over. I suppose they could sell it at some point, but it isn't going to be an NEA-owned transmission line. Whatever gets built with federal dollars in the grid of the future here, or the grid of the first world, because we don't have that, is going to be owned by the state. And so when I add all of that up, I think, gosh, we need institutional reform on transmission ownership and operation such that we can facilitate, you know, reliability, affordability, and resiliency. And we can start checking off and eliminating some of those, like, security constraints that you know, will, if you can economic dispatch from Homer to Fairbanks, we're going to save money. I mean, I can't tell you we get too close to 10 cents, but it's going to put downward pressure on rates. So that's why I would say, you know, grid innovation and the transmission ownership structure, it's going to have to change, because if we get any of the federal dollars, we will be creating more fragmentation. And it's an opportunity, I think, to consolidate it. I don't know that you could force selling it. Some utilities are highly leveraged. One utility is seeking a 30% increase in its transmission rate before the commission right now. That is going to increase Bradley Lake Wheeling by 22%. So if that goes through, getting my Bradley power, the Wheeling of that power is going to go up 22%. Same for Fairbanks region. I just think all of these things added up are an outcry and opportunity to restructure it. And then you talk about Iceland, and I'll get off my soapbox. Iceland is a model where they went in with fragmented utility ownership, and they leased some of that transmission, because you can't force a sale, but you can effectively operate it as a single entity while allowing that utility to maintain its debt covenants. And now I'm officially off the soapbox.
Yeah, and Tony, just so you know, Carl has hand raised.
Yeah, go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, I was only wanted to say that I think you've articulated it very well, Tony, and I concur 100%, and I think that this group does know enough to advocate for the action of the consolidation as you've recommended. I don't think we should be developing a plan about how to do it, not whether to do it. And so I think the task force can be bold enough to make that recommendation.
I agree, and I think we have to do it. One of the other opportunities that comes along with this, similar to the Iceland model, is if the state wants to invest, and a legislator called me today and was asking a few questions about some of the GRIP applications and the IRA and what if we receive dollars from transmission. And the thought that I shared was, you know, if we go to the state for a match, we should be explaining to the state what it is we expect to get for that match and how are we going to measure it. And And I don't see why we couldn't do that. I strongly support a recommendation because I think a different kind of construct, let's say it's all owned by the state under AEA, which today is the steward for the state's transmission and Bradley Lake hydro assets, that puts us in a position where the state would have some choices. It could decide at that point, well, heck, if we were to fund X amount to eliminate the debt on that entity, that structure, you know, here's a direct direct improvement in the, not only the cost of moving power, but the cost for independent power producers to come on and provide that power. I think you incentivize, and Jen, now I'm in your area of, you know, expertise. You're the entrepreneurial arm of this business, and I'm in the more traditional defined box of the business. So, you know, what are your thoughts there?
I mean, I think, I'm with you guys. I'm new to the, I heard the idea of how Iceland had set up their transmission assets, and I think it sounds like a good idea. You guys have a lot more background there. I know from an ICP standpoint, if wheeling charges were established and that was a published value across the grid, it would be much easier for ICP projects to be proposed or assessed and proposed to utilities, because right now there's a lot of uncertainty in that space. And then if each utility has to define its own rate case or wheeling charge, then that slows down projects because that has to get approved by the regulatory commission before it can move forward. So from an ICP and interconnecting new generation assets, I certainly think having published wheeling charges across the transmission system will be, it will definitely reduce project development timelines. So I think, I'm with you guys on Rail Belt 1. And it almost seems like down below where there's discussion of improving the transmission. Let me see, which one is that? It says Rail Belt transmission line capacity expansion. I feel like that one we could kind of link up, you know, within the transmission category.
Absolutely.
Excuse me. And that one we could potentially flesh out a little bit more with more specific. I like how the action description is on Rail Belt 1, where it's a little bit more specific. And potentially, if we could have with Dave Burlingame, who could do a presentation on the transmission system, because maybe I feel like that's been analyzed a lot, and maybe there's specific recommendations that we'd want to make within that.
Yeah, Jen, really that is what Brian Hickey has put together and presented to the group back, a little bit. I think if we had more months to work with, I would recommend Dave coming in and doing kind of a one-on-one on transmission. I've shifted my opinion a bit based on the timeline.
Okay, apologies if Brian already has kind of a consolidated analysis, but I think these recommendations would be good. I like how number one is structured, and even the one that talks about assessing multiple supply and demand scenarios, Rail Belt 4. I guess I would love for the group to, we talked about last time, getting a summary of different generation types and what their cost is, time to deployment, technology readiness level is. But if we could have a view of that during our workshop in the morning, potentially Rail Belt 4, we could flesh out to say we would like these specific scenarios analyzed. Because, I'd love to see, obviously a solar, wind, natural gas mix, a nuclear option, a hydro, what if Bradford Lake is done, and kind of maybe we could build out what those cases are just to put a little more definition around that recommendation.
And Jen, just to pause here, I know Hua from Black and Beach is on, and I just wanted to, pause here and ask them if that's something that they're capable of preparing for the September 14th meeting. And Jen, you may want to just, pause and kind of talk about what you might need for that
Yeah, I think we can definitely support the team on that and trying to really draw out the current existing generation portfolio, the mix and the relative cost, and I think then the probably expected cost. But I think some of those will be based on what we got from the historical data, and also I would like to invest the credit before we actually review it during the meeting. And Jennifer, if you have a specific kind of type of information you are looking for, what would be emphasized and how you like the scenario to be really derived from that statistic table, and I think we would like to see kind of what kind of requirement you need from us.
Thanks. Yeah, I think for the, maybe to see whether it's a table or a presentation, but really just looking for some benchmark data on a dollar per kilowatt hour for each generation type, so solar, wind, Alaska's natural gas, imported LNG, the proposed LNG project, hydro, and just kind of the more common prevalent technologies that are at a point where they're ready to deploy. But really just looking across those generation types, what is their dollar per kilowatt hour, reliability, permitting complexity, carbon impact, and implementation timeline. And so that way, I think if we could kind of see what some of the different technologies dollar per kilowatt hour is, then we could say, okay, you know, if we were, it doesn't sound like we're going to have time to evaluate the multiple scenarios before the completion of this initial task force report is done. But I think we could at least outline what are the, I mean, literally just like what I just said, like, okay, we want to see a case that is, you know, wind, solar, and natural gas, kind of like Australia. We want to see a case with hydro. You know, I think the group could use their judgment to come up with some of these scenarios, because I think we just want to see, but if we had some of the information on what those generation types are and their metrics, really just like from national benchmark data, I think that would help us see what are the most common potential cases we could look at going forward.
We are looking for kind of like a general benchmark on the type of technologies, and we may, and in a lot of places, because especially from a cost perspective, it may be specific for a certain location or resource. What we do, we can do is to provide a range. I think then we understand it's not going to be specific to a master project. That's what we were thinking of. You want us to really maybe just provide some very high-level opinion regarding what we think the cost in Alaska could have been, just because we understand that, I mean, especially from a labor installation perspective and because of the shorter construction period, the cost could be potentially a little bit higher than in Alaska than in elsewhere of the U.S. Lower 48.
And I don't know, it might be good just to show national benchmark data without it being adjusted and allow us to decide if we, I don't know. I get a little bit, just from my background, I get a little bit cautious of when people start putting in like Alaska modifiers, because they're not always real. And so I just like, I'd rather have just kind of like true benchmark data and let us decide where we really need to adjust. But I'm happy to take a look at anything you prepare ahead of the 14th meeting. And Tony, that was just one of the topics that from our last meeting, I think that on the generation side and storage side, I think people were just saying, hey, that's kind of the one thing that hasn't been presented yet. It's just the benchmark data on costs and, you know, permitting complexity and reliability, some of those things that the group wanted to see to help inform future scenarios. Is that right?
Yeah, we can do help with that, yes.
Yes, Jen. A number of thoughts, because I think you're really onto something here, and I'm just thinking through the best way to address it. you know, when, and I always have to kind of step back and I think about the dashboard or of kind of what's on my radar screen, near term, short, short term, near term, long term, what are the variables that hopefully I can at least define a range that they might come in at. There's public policy aspects of that. When President Biden indicated he wanted net zero power generation, I think it was 2035, maybe 2030. It was an executive order, it had no force of law, but we in the business, we immediately started looking at, based on things that we deal with, material, supply chain, et cetera, how could you achieve that? I don't have an answer yet. But what has been done that might help us is, I guess there's an upcoming NREL study update. When the governor introduced the Renewable Portfolio Standard legislation a couple years ago, NREL was asked to do a study of what it would save. And one of the things we in the rail belt, it was focused on the rail belt, we realized right away was that the NREL report indicated that by 2040 you would save something like $500 million a year. Of course, what they did was they took the cost of fuel in 2021 or two and they compounded by 4% per year, and then that's exactly how they got to that fuel savings number. What they didn't do was include the economic impact or the capital cost and debt associated with replacing it. It was kind of a one-sided, well, here's what you could save if you did all of this. Of course, so we had, MEA had somebody go, run that for us. I think it was Burns and McDonald. And we found there were multiple ways to get there. But none that, none that reduced rates. Every one of them just, increased rates at some level or another. I believe that this updated NREL study that's coming out is supposed to include the economic analysis associated with the cost to replace the natural gas fired infrastructure with a variety of renewable solar, wind. My concern with that report is I understand that there's a trade-off. I understand that there's a party that was able to get nuclear taken out of that, unfortunately. But that might be instructive. And then I've got an updated analysis being done that I might be able to share. I'll have to look at that. So I need to kind of shift to a different way that I look at this. For example, and that is, I look at it. We have power supply, and for MEA that's solar, that's hydro, that's natural gas. There are a variety of contracts, and how we maximize the efficiency of those. I have power delivery, which is think of more the assets, transmission. How do you get it? How do you get it from the generation to the user? And when I separate out just generation, right today, I have just a massive concern that's unprecedented. It's historical in that we're going to be having natural gas supply and cost issues as soon as next year for one utility. For the others, MEA and Chugach, it's more like 2028, could be the winter of 2027. And so, while I'm thinking about the best workout plan at the Alaska Club, I need to keep the patient alive so that they can actually lift those weights and get on that treadmill. And so, the health plan is really important, but right today, the potential economic impact of some of the draft, you know, some of the variables, unknown variables that were just plugging in some numbers, you know, could represent significant, you know, 20% increase in rates across the board. And of course that rings the bell very loudly for me around the affordability, tenet of, you know, what we're doing. And so it seems like, you know, as a committee, I would suggest that, you know, we're going to have to, maybe with help, from HUA, the, you know, another, maybe it's NREL or other sources, you know, we're going to have to pick something. And I personally believe it's going to be everything's on the table. I've gone and I've looked at the nuclear, and they're telling me it's 2031, 2032 or 3, before I might be able to buy any of that and put it in, because I don't want to buy serial number one. If you want to see serial number one, go look at Healy 2, you know, that operates 53% of the time. And so I think we have the information to make some very high level recommendations. I think John Sims needs to speak to us about the gas issue. He doesn't have a replacement. He can mix propane and air, but that's importing as well. That's a substitute for methane. But I think we've got some near term triage things we need to do. And then on the generation and the supply and demand scenarios, I think we have to look at, well, what's realistic within, say, this decade, or what do we know is going to be on the table in the next decade? Really today, if you wanted to solve this so-called railway fuel supply issue, it would have to be a moonshot kind of a project where you'd have to pick probably one of three things. You'd have to build a large traditional nuclear power plant and the transmission associated with it to get everybody connected. And you'd have to be able to achieve that by the time the gas, you know, starts to supply is a real problem. That's maybe 5 years. We might be able to extend that a few. You could go with a very large hydro project. And that's a recommendation on this list as well, with Susitna-Wetana. But, you know, from my perspective, you have federal issues there. Well, it may be prudent to finish the permitting. You know, we don't have control over that. The federal government is going to decide that. And so if you're telling me as a utility operator that, you know, I don't get to choose which week or month or year you don't have power so that I can find the cheapest thing, I mean, it has to be on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, et cetera. Then that leads me, you know, back to the infrastructure that's here, which is natural gas. And, you know, there's the North Slope gas proposals that, you know, some have talked about. And anyway, I think it's going to be a mix of things, and some of it's going to be painful and some not. And I would hate to see anything knocked off the list, because I don't think we're going to get a silver bullet line, or, you know, some new technology that's going to fall out of the sky that will fix everything tomorrow.
I just have this for a proposal. Michael, could we organize these actions by generation, storage, transmission, and then kind of as we go throughout the day on the 14th, you know, ahead of the generation discussion, have HUA present those benchmark metrics to SOPIA, and maybe that's like a half hour, because really this is just a table and going through the pros and cons of different technologies, and then we can kind of just talk through all the recommendations that are related to generation. Mm-hmm. Then we could also have a, you know, brief presentation on storage options, talk about that, and then head into transmission. And I know there was some discussion if we should couple transmission and storage, but I think if we kind of go through it that way and then close on policy, that could be like a way to go through these actions with the group and consolidate them and mm-hmm. see which ones we have, you know, enough momentum behind that we want to, you know, these are our consolidated list. I guess, yeah, Michael and Tony, what do you guys think about that as far as a structure for the 14th?
I'll let Tony go first.
I was going to defer to you, Michael. Please go ahead and I'll weigh in.
No, I think that's good, and that's not only a good way to organize it for the meeting, but that you could create strategies around that, and then these are the actions that relate to it. So you're kind of advancing the report and also just the discussion.
I'm going to model my response, you know, to be concise after yours, Michael. And yeah, I completely agree, Jen. That's really what I was trying to get to is I think if you take the generation, you take the transmission, you know, the power supply, the power delivery, the fuel supply, you know, you've got three main primary components, and things like battery storage can be used for to increase the capacity factor and make something more economic, storage can mean instead of building massive tanks along the coast in the Kenai Peninsula for liquefied natural gas, if you regas it on the ship and connect into the system, I know that there's a producer that has a lot of gas well storage that you could dump billions of cubic feet, you know, a day into. Manus Electric could take two cargoes, for example, and you know, take those two cargoes in July, and we'd have our gas until the next June or July. And that may be an interim solution. So I look at storage as energy storage, and it can be a delivery, power delivery asset or tool, and it's also a generation asset or tool. And then break it down into these, like, well, what do we have in the near term versus what do we want the long term to look like? And then how do these things add up to a, to addressing the, you know, the goals in the governor's executive order?
Carl?
Yeah, I like what you're saying, Tony and Jen. I would just offer one thing that would be useful for me, before the 14th or as part of the discussion on the 14th is consider the Cook Inlet Basin, you know, maturity issue from the context of Alaska has a history of when the gas gets short, we pass some tax incentives and charge a bunch of operators to go out there and drill and produce, and then it kind of takes the pain away for a few years. So we're used to doing that. We know how to do that. It's kind of a local solution. Sounds like a good solution, but, you know, one thing I think this group could do is to try to, because I know Tony and you and John have been involved in these discussions a lot, but, and everybody wants to run, you know, have cover, but just to try to get some sense for whether that kind of a policy is kind of run its course and we don't have confidence that it's a mid or long-term solution. And therefore we need to be thinking, you know, outside the box, different than we thought before about just incentivizing a local production. Because that, when, unfortunately, you know, if these things get to the legislature, that there'll probably be a lot of familiarity with that approach and we have to maybe look for more if that's the recommendation. So that's just something that I would be interested in learning about.
I think John Sims and myself, who, you know, even Curtis Thayer, you know, we've had front row seats for the last few decades, and rather than, you know, try to jump to and present a proposed conclusion for you to reach and, you know, think about how we, you know, how we do that. I could certainly.
It could be simple.
I mean, I could do it in, you know, it would take me probably 15 minutes to give you the rundown of, you know, where things are at the strategic planning day and add another 15 for questions. Because you're asking, you know, the conclusion is that would be the most economic solution. But we're facing circumstances that are very different than we have in the past. But it would take another, I would propose that maybe we make it part of that agenda.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah.
And one other topic, just kind of following the lessons from Iceland, the other one that we talked about quite a bit during one meeting was just about how do we, and this is not a triage or near-term issue, but it is kind of, if we want to set the state up long-term, you know, ideas around increasing demand to spread out the overhead costs and reduce rates that way. And so I guess, you know, we talked about generation, storage, transmission, and if we could include just maybe a half hour, an hour on demand, just so that we don't miss that piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, Jenna, you know, I have some samples of very recent demand scenarios that I performed from, you know, my utility, or I have performed from mine. And then there are demand scenarios in the BRG report that was led by NSTAR, as well as the Black and Veatch report that Chugach Electric recently filed with the commission. So I think, you know, I think all of that is there. It's probably a matter of pulling out those particular pages, because they show kind of low growth, high growth. They mix it up with, you know, percentages of renewables. And I'll just stop there and say I can certainly look for something like that. Or should we ask Black and Veatch or Michael Baker, you know, what are your thoughts on how we might satisfy that need for, as Jen described?
I'll defer to Black and Veatch on that, just because it's more their area of expertise. Ooh, I'm not, if you're speaking, you're muted. And for her a second, if not, Carl. Okay. No.
I think we can definitely help kind of with the Black and Veatch portion of the Chugach setting. We actually have scenarios regarding, we understand what the assumptions behind the scenarios, and so understand basically what Chugach projects as the need for gas and the potential gap that they are seeing in the gas supply part of it. But for the BRG study, we were not very involved in that. We can definitely present the results, but we may not be able to really tell intelligence as to what was the underlying assumption that's goes behind those numbers. But if it's just like where the lines are and estimate a potential range of gas, we can definitely pull some information from the BRG report and just really show what the study was showing.
Okay, yeah, I think just have that information in the room, and then I guess rather than like what has been a discussion with the task force about, would we, you know, make any kind of recommendation about trying to attract larger industry to increase our number, our customers and demand, and would that, you know, help us with our dollar per kilowatt hour? So not really what has been and what the traditional, like, forecasted demand is, but, like, would we try and change kind of the economic structure and demand structure materially to impact rates? Similar to Iceland. So kind of an out there concept, I recognize. But just that was definitely a lesson for me from the Iceland. And I'll pass it off to Carl because he's had his hand raised.
No, I was just going to say my sense of what Jen, you're asking for, was just precisely what you just summarized, some sort of a bigger picture look at what opportunities might there be to attract industry and change our electricity rates perhaps by broadening the base and so I just didn't want to get focused on rear view looking things as much and not just forecasting kind of the status quo, which lately in Alaska has been a no growth scenario, you know, more like, you know, what are there ideas, and I'm not proposing any of them. The only one I've heard that, and I have no idea if it has legs, is this, you know, hydrogen center and Cook Inlet kind of a thing, with sequestration and kind of a big connected with the LNG project. And I know that one of our task force members is working on that but I don't know enough about it to know whether that's something that, you know, we should get behind in order to enhance, our economic opportunities, including electricity growth. I don't know.
And maybe it is just like a back of the envelope. Oh, if we, added 50% more demand, what would that do to our electricity rates? There's still the per kilowatt hour kind of fuel or generation cost, but how does it spread out our overhead? Just so we can kind of see what the impact of that is and then say, you know, we don't have to know the answer of how we do it, but making a recommendation of, you know, if we think that's something the state should look into. I mean, I'm sure the state's already looking into how to bring more business to the state.
Jen, to your point, too, this is like that integration with the SEDS plan, you know, for economic development and energy. So those two plans should talk to each other.
Jen, this is Tony. I completely agree. I can look at transmission, you know, again, as this power delivery, you know, set of assets. I can talk about them and the size. I can talk about what, you know, might be needed. But in the traditional utility structure, you're only going to build, you don't build a lot of extra capacity in that old, if you build it, they will come philosophy. And I do think that the Iceland model is a good example. It intrigues me because you're going to invest in a whole bunch of transmission for the sake of doing it. That's a question. If you're going to invest in a whole bunch of generation for the sake of doing it, that's a question. But if you're going to do both of those things, say, to a capacity that's 2 or 3 or 4 times more than what the demand is today, there has to be an economic development component of that to sell what that is. And I think you raised a good point, because I don't know at what scale, you know, Iceland with aluminum smelters, I don't know what scale that was. But I do think with the state's help, you can get outside of the, especially with transmission, you can get outside of that traditional regulatory, you know, cost causer, cost payer construct. And you can build, you know, you can build for those things, but you better have agreement with the person who's footing the bill. It's not the ratepayer. That's what you're going to want to know. What are we getting? So I really like it. I think you're onto something there. And it would be helpful to maybe look at orders of magnitude, not 10, but, you know, 2, 3, 4 times. We are not a big grid when it comes down to it, overall.
Okay, great. Well, then I think that would be a good discussion topic. And then I know we're almost at time here. I guess, Michael, to prepare for the 14th, what do you need from us?
I think we're going to take the notes from this meeting and then kind of help create that preliminary agenda based off of the topics we discussed. It might be helpful if you and Tony kind of take another look at this, kind of the tracking sheet, and make any kind of changes that were discussed, just so the wording is exactly so. And then it can be a discussion, you know, for the meeting.
Okay, great. And I'll be out of the office actually pretty soon after this call through the end of the week, but I'll be back on Monday and can Monday next weekend we'll definitely do that.
Okay. Yeah, we're happy to listen to the recording and make the updates, but I just don't want to make any assumptions because, you know, you've all been so articulate. And it looks like Tony just gave his thumbs up, so.
Okay, great. Well, any closing thoughts from anyone before we wrap up?
Okay.
All right, Michael, thanks for the agenda and for facilitating, and I look forward to seeing everybody on the 14th for the all-day session.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, all. Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
Bye, Tony.